Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Jessica Jaber. She was a Marine Corps veteran, and she served in Iraq as a truck driver, and she had some experiences over there that she's coming on to share with us and share with us how she has transitioned since coming back and all the things that she has kind of gone through. So welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. We talked a little bit earlier today, just a little bit of background on your story for the people who are listening to this. And so we kind of dug in a little bit to your story, and I'd like to kind of start from maybe the beginning and talk about, you know, how you joined the Marine Corps and how you got into that and what those early days were like when you first joined.
Yeah. So, I'll just jump right in. So again, thanks for having me, Scott. This is really exciting. So I was 18 when I joined the Marine Corps. And I joined on a dare. My family did not, or I didn't come from a family of military brothers or parents or grandparents. And so for me to join the Marine Corps was kind of just, it was out of the normal. So a really good friend of mine, he joined the Marine Corps, came back in his dress blues, came out with a group of friends. And I just said out of the blue, what would you say if I joined the Marine Corps? And he's like, oh, no way. We just did this. We just did this crucible. We just did this. And he's like, I don't think you would be able to do it. And so that was on a Friday night. And then Monday, I was in the recruiter's office signing up. So this is how I joined the Marine Corps. It wasn't like a lifelong dream of mine. Right. So.
Yeah, I like that story because it's like, you know what, let's just do it. And why not? And it's, you know, for a good cause, you know, serving your country. And, at the time, did you have any career expectations or college expectations, you know, in your future? Or was it something like you were 18 and were kind of like, I don't really know what's going on with my life, and this sounds better than the alternatives? Was that kind of like what it was?
That's exactly what it was. I wasn't interested in going to school anymore. Didn't really have any passions. And so I'm like, yeah, Marines, let's do it.
Right. So, I mean, and again, it's a good career path in the military. You can learn a lot of things. You can get a skill that can, you can translate to the civilian world later on if that's something that you're interested in. So, and when we talked earlier, you didn't really have any career path in mind with the Marine Corps, right? You just kind of said, put me where you need me, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to be a Marine. So when you do that, you know, they just sign you up for whatever billets they have open. So I ended up being Motor T, a truck driver. So,
right. So yeah, that's, That could be a little scary of an experience going into it, not knowing exactly what you're going to be doing, because you sign a contract for X number of years and you could be put in a job that you're going to totally hate. But there's a little leap of faith there, right? You're like, you know what? I don't care. I just want to be a Marine, and that's what I'm going to do, right?
That's exactly what happened. Yep.
Yeah. So you go through the basic training and you get through all of that and you get assigned to your first unit. How was that like going in there? I can't imagine in the Motor T, there's too many females who were just jumping to sign up for that job, right?
Right. Right. There was only a couple of us. And this is back in the year 2000. So it's over 20 years ago, right? So right. I joined, got into the fleet. I was stationed at Camp Pendleton. And my unit, I was the only female in my platoon at the time. We had a few more in the company. But yeah, my first week there, we were in the barracks and we shared, we had shared laundry facilities. So, the way that I was welcomed into the Marine Corps, which set the pace for my career there, was, I'm not sure who exactly it was, but they stole my laundry and scattered it all over the barracks, all over the hallways. So this was, like I said, this was in 2000, but this was how I was welcomed into the Marine Corps. So.
Yeah, and that's when we were talking before, you told, shared that story with me, and you know, in the military we a lot of times we'll do stupid pranks like that, but that's not exactly the way you want to welcome someone into a unit where you are you know, potentially going to, and at that point no one really knew that we were going to war or anything in the near future, but you know, you're potentially going to have to be looking out for each other, and you don't want to start things off at the wrong foot like that. So, you know, it's unfortunate that stuff like that happens, but hopefully, things changed as time went on. And you know, 9/11 happens, and you know, then all of that ramp up to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, comes up, and people hopefully are starting to take things a little bit more seriously. Right.
Yeah, for sure.
And so speaking of 9/11, we didn't mention this earlier when we were talking, but, where were you? What was that like for you when news of all of that took place?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We didn't get into this. I actually flew into, Washington Reagan, airport in DC or near DC, on September 10th. Okay. I was supposed to be in Quantico on September 11th, which I was. I ended up being in Quantico, but that night I drove past the Pentagon, and then so I was actually away from my unit when 9/11 happened, and I was actually on the East Coast at Quantico. So I was not near any of my, you know, any of my equipment, right?
Yeah.
And so I was stuck in Quantico. I think it was a week and a half before they let any of the flights start leaving from there. So, yeah, that's where I was.
Yeah, and that had to be pretty scary being away from your unit and all the people that you knew. I mean, you were still with other Marines and things like that where you were, but still, it's a crazy time. You don't know what's going on. Nobody knows really what was going on at that point. Yeah. It was all new to all of us. And so, yeah, that's interesting. I always like to hear where people were and what they were doing, if they were in the military when 9/11 happened, just because it's just a part of our country's history that, I think it's one of those things like the Kennedy assassination, if you're old enough for that, or the, you know, other things like that, where you just know where you were and what you were doing at that time, you know, the moon landing or whatever. September 11th, same thing. I think anyone who was around that time, old enough to know what was going on, knew where they were, knew what was going on. But it's interesting to hear from a military perspective where people were and what was going through their minds at that point, right?
Yeah, it was a crazy time.
Yeah, so then I guess fast forward a couple of years and you find yourself in Iraq, right?
Yeah, I went to Iraq in 2003. So I actually got called home on, I was on Christmas leave. So 2002, I got called home or called back into the, called back to base. And in January of 2003, we boarded the USS Boxer, and we floated over to Kuwait. So it took us about 5 weeks to get there. And then, yeah, we stayed there for a couple of weeks. We were in Kuwait for a couple of weeks, and then the war officially started.
Right. And so you guys being the truck drivers, you were the ones who were driving up from Kuwait, right? Is that how you basically convoyed up to wherever you were going, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's how we came over on ships, right? And so we brought most of our vehicles along with us. And then, yeah, we drove our trucks up.
Yeah, and you went up to Baghdad, correct?
Right. Yeah. We started, like I said, we started in Kuwait. We crossed the line of departure and ended up in Baghdad on April 9th, I remember, which was, I think, the official end of the war. It's funny they say that.
It's like, all right, we're here for the party, and then
right
what's going on, right?
I think that was the word, is that the war has ended, but we know that wasn't true. So
so
we spent some time in Baghdad, ended up going south a little bit to Talil Air Base, and we were stationed we kind of parked there for a few months, and ended up coming home in September of 2003. So I spent about 6 months in country.
Yeah. So. And so when you were there, what was the job that you had, and what were you guys doing, and where did that take you? How did that all work out for you? What were your experiences like over there?
Yeah. So, we were a supply unit. So we provided bullets, beans, band-aids for the, 1st Marine Division. So, we had medics attached to us, Navy medics. And so anywhere that the 1st Marine Division went, we would follow in lockstep. Sometimes we were in front of them so they could just drive right up and get their supplies, get their fuel. My specific job, I did have a Humvee when we got off a ship, except it started on fire as soon as we got on land. You know, love that equipment we got.
That military grade equipment, right?
I ended up being a passenger then the rest of the time, and worked the communications for our vehicle.
Right, and during that time, you know, you're driving around. It's a hostile area to be in, and so, you know, naturally you're probably seeing some combat throughout this deployment, correct?
Yes. So I was in the lead a couple of vehicles, so we drove around with the CO and gunnery sergeant. So we were out scouting a lot of places before we brought along the rest of the company. We ventured over the Tigris, we ventured over the Euphrates bridges. So we actually got a couple of combat action ribbons out of that deployment. So,
yeah. And that's something that I think, when people hear about other people's deployments, and if someone was saying, "Oh, well, I was a truck driver, and I was driving around," people don't necessarily think combat with that, right? That's not the thing that pops to the top of your head when you're thinking about someone and the job that they're doing. It's like, okay, well, you were just driving a truck, right? But that's not true either. You're driving a truck, but you're driving it in a hostile territory, and the people who are on the other side of the enemy, really, they don't care what your job is. They they see, you know, Americans, and they want to take out as many of them as they can. So they don't care that you're a truck driver or a cook or a mechanic or whatever. They just see you as an American, and that's all they care about. And they don't care really what your job is. Whatever your job is, it's there to help the Americans, and that's not what they want. So I think that's an important perspective for people to understand, is that no matter what you did over there, you were, even if you were on the base the entire time, you still were in danger 24/7 to some extent, because bases get mortared, bases get, suicide bombers driving into the bases and things like that. Mm-hmm. All these things happen. And so, at any point, that could have happened to anybody who gets deployed. And so when we're talking to other combat vets or other people who've deployed to combat zones, whether they've directly seen combat or not, it's one of those things where you have to constantly be on alert, for those mm-hmm. things to happen. And that's part of the training that you get too, is you always need to be alert, head on a swivel, all that kind of stuff. And so it's important, I think, for those people who haven't experienced these things to recognize that, that when there are those people who were quote unquote, just a truck driver or just a cook or just a whatever, mm-hmm. They probably had to experience a lot of the same kind of things. Maybe it wasn't on a every single day basis, but they still had to experience it. And that still, that heightened sense of alertness and everything like that still goes along with all of that. And when you come back home, that's one of those things that's kind of hard to shut off, right?
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. That heightened sense of alert is always on the ready. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's hard. I've been there too. I was an infantryman and so we were in Afghanistan and you're always looking for that next person who's going to jump out with a mm-hmm. rifle or an RPG or a whatever. That's just what you're trained to do. And you're always doing it. And then you come home and you're walking in Walmart or, you know, whatever. And it's like, you don't have to be constantly, you know, head on a swivel, looking down all the aisles and all that kind of stuff. Well, maybe Walmart's not the best example, but, you know, but you know, it's one of those things where if you're constantly on alert, you don't know how to shut that down. And so that's kind of what I wanted to get into with you is to talk about, you know, how you've transitioned since getting back home and getting out of the military, and how you have adjusted to civilian life and making the best of what you have going on, right?
Yeah. So, you know, so I have some struggles, and not just from combat, just I think some of the events that happened in the military in general, right? Is we're kind of conditioned to not be too emotional, right? Not to show your emotions, not to show affection or love or empathy. And I still struggle with that 20 years later. So that's something that I've noticed, I've recognized, and have been trying to work on, over the last 20 years. I've been through a couple of divorces, based on my, struggle with showing my emotions, being open, being, authentic, right? I always have this tough girl kind of armor up that it's really hard to bring people in and to let people in. So that's one of those things that I continue to struggle with is being vulnerable, showing my emotions, knowing that it's okay to show your emotions.
right. And that's one of the things that we like to talk about on this show too, is that it's okay to open up and talk about things, you know, and showing emotions, that's part of it too, I think. And I think a lot of people in the military struggle with that too. You know, that tough guy mentality, you know, you can't show your emotions or any of that kind of, like, why? Like, who wrote that rule? And like, where can I go kick his ass? Because like that's not true. Like, why can't you show your emotions? Why can't you talk about things like that? That should be part of like just normal life, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I've been getting a lot of help through we have a, and I'm not sure if this is nationwide, but it's called the Vet Center. In Milwaukee. I'm in Wisconsin. So, we have this vet center who has great, she's just a great lady that I've been working with for the past 10 years, actually. Our work is very specific on feeling these emotions as much as, I don't want to do that, but it's very healthy, I think.
Right. Yeah. And it is to like slowly relearn how to feel those emotions, because It's strange because at one point or another, we all were civilians and we all had the, I'll just say, normal civilian mindset about things. And then we go through the military and we get drilled into us. This is how it is. And this is how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to behave and all this kind of stuff. And then we get out and we're like, okay, well, that's how I'm supposed to behave. So I'm just going to continue behaving that way. So we all knew at one point how to have emotions, but then we get that drilled out of us. And now it's like a struggle to pick that back up. And I get that, like that does make some sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you had trouble with the emotions and making connections with people. Is certainly difficult, especially when you're talking about relationships like a marriage and stuff. That's a hard thing to have to go through. Not only for yourself, but also for your spouse to be trying to make the connection and just not seeming like anything was sticking. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's hard, and it's one of those things that you do have, you know, you try to work on. You have to try to make that better for yourself, for the other people in your life, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you also mentioned earlier about these panic attacks that you were having. And would you be willing to share anything about that? I thought it was interesting what you're saying and kind of like what was happening with that in your situation. And I'd love to be able to kind of dig into that a little bit if you're willing to share any of that.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing that I struggled with is really that heightened anxiety, something bad is going to happen. And it led to somewhat of these panic attacks where I would have these episodes and my body was actually shutting down. My heart was stopping. Because, you know, there's that fight or flight or freeze kind of thing that happens to your body. And my body, when it was scared, when it thought something bad was going to happen, it stopped. You know, my heart stopped. And, you know, I had these tests done. You know, nothing was wrong with my brain. Nothing was wrong with my heart. Nothing. I didn't have cancer. Nothing was wrong with me. Until we actually caught one of these episodes on, we actually caught what was actually happening. So I was at the Madison VA and they saw what was happening and my heart had stopped for 20 seconds, all because I was about to get, or I got a shot. So I was like, afraid of needles, right? So I got this shot and I'm like, oh no, and almost panicked. And I actually did panic and I had an episode and my heart stopped. So they saw that my heart stopped for 20 seconds. And that had been happening almost on a weekly basis after I got out of the military.
Wow. And so just to clarify, just so people who are listening, because we talked about this earlier, so I knew a little bit of what you're talking about here. But when you say that your heart stopped, it's not like, like in the songs when someone says like, oh, my heart skipped a beat when I saw that. No, it wasn't. It's not like that. It's like your heart literally stopped beating for those 20 seconds. There was like no pumping, no blood flow, nothing like that for 20 seconds. And so that was leading to, obviously you're passing out in that form, right? But then it led to seizures as well, right?
Yeah, it was so my heart was stopping for such a long time that it had my body going into seizure like activities.
So. Right. Yeah. So so what ended up happening with all that? Like is that something that could keep happening, or is this, is it under control? What's going on with all that?
Yeah. So I was fortunate that they being the VA, they saw what was happening. And so that same, 2 days later, I had a pacemaker put in. So the pacemaker, it doesn't cure like the root cause, right? It doesn't cure that, the anxiety or whatever is causing that panic. But it's keeping my heart beating. So
That's important.
Helping the symptoms, right? So yeah. And so that was,
I wasn't the best biology student, but I know that that's a big thing. So you want to keep that thing going. So that's good.
I need it a little bit.
Yeah, right. So that's good. So, but there's still the panic attacks, right? That's something that hasn't been cured necessarily by the pacemaker, right?
Right. So I still get, you know, heightened awareness, anxiety. I was mentioning that, you know, we cross the Euphrates, we cross the Tigris River. I still struggle with crossing bridges. I have a panic when I need to cross a bridge. I'm just driving over a long bridge. My heart doesn't stop anymore, which is great.
Which is especially great for the driver, right?
Oh my gosh. Right. But yeah, so there's still some of that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's interesting, like the things that trigger different people from their experiences overseas. Like you're saying, driving over a bridge is something that triggers this panic attack and this anxiety. Mm-hmm. But I've talked to so many people who have different things, not necessarily driving over a bridge, but other things that are just part of normal everyday life. And they trigger this reaction, this anxiety and panic in them. And it makes it really hard to just go through your day-to-day life, especially if you live in an area where there's a lot of bridges, right? For someone like yourself, or if you, have a lot of, other triggers around you, then it makes it hard and you almost feel like you want to just seclude yourself and stay away from all those things. But that's not always the best solution to the problem, right?
No, exactly. You have to really go out there every day and, you know, face your fears or face your struggles and find things that'll help.
Yeah, for sure. And that's just to clarify, that's not saying like if you have a fear of being shot that you're not going to go and have people start shooting at you to face your fear. So like that's not what we're talking about. But if your fear is of the loud noises from a gunshot or something like that, then maybe, popping balloons or something like that to trigger that same kind of reaction, but in a much safer way, going and standing out on the other end of a shooting range or whatever, like that would be a bad idea. Don't do that. Right. So, this anxiety and the PTSD is sort of been a part of your life for the last 20-ish years or so. Yeah. How have you managed with that? What have you done to try to cope with that to, get through these things and be able to live with it or live better with it for maybe a better way to put it?
Yeah. So, it took me a while, but I've been trying to learn to embrace this part of me because it is ingrained. It is a part of me now, this anxiety, this anxiousness that I feel and always being on the ready. So, I've tried multiple things over the years. Medication helps me when, the everyday, it was just a hard time to get through every day. So I turned to medication, that has been helpful sometimes. I've also tried massages, just going in and getting those really tight spots. I mean, anybody would enjoy a massage, right? But right. The VA actually pays for me to go into the community and get these deep tissue massages to relieve some of that stress, that tension that's always in my jaw, or always in my body. So just to help relax my body.
You mentioned that when we were talking earlier, and I'm glad that you brought it up again, because that was something I didn't realize that the VA would cover. And I'm sure a lot of other people probably didn't realize that either. But like you were talking about, like that tension in your jaw or in your shoulders or in your back or whatever, that tension that you just carry around, a massage could really help release some of that tension and alleviate some of that. if the VA is going to pay for it too, like give it a try. Right. I think it's worth a shot. I mean, at the end of the day, maybe it doesn't have long-term benefits for someone, but you got a massage out of the deal. So it's not that bad.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, it's a bonus that the VA offered that to me.
I'm really glad you mentioned it. And there were some other things like the massage and other things that I wasn't sure that the VA would even cover, but you said there were some other things that you've tried as well with varying degrees of success, right?
Yeah. So I have tried acupuncture, which was an option that they offered to go out into the community and get acupuncture, because they don't specifically offer that at the VA, but it's through what's called community care is what it's called for near me. And I don't think these options were that available maybe 20 years ago, but I feel like the VA might be getting more options recently. These are really great, easy things that may help, may not help. I didn't care for the acupuncture too much.
Well, it's that needle thing, right? I mean,
right. We'll just stay away from needles, but I think that could help some other people a lot. I've read a lot about it, so
yeah, for sure. And I think these are good options. And I think the community care is a more recent thing. I think it's within the last few years that they started opening it up to other services that were not necessarily provided by the VA, but could also help the veteran. So they open it up so that you can get the treatment at a civilian acupuncturist or massage place or whatever. And so these are definite options. And so how did you go about finding out, first off, that the VA even would cover these things? And how did you approach that subject? Was it through your primary care doctor at the VA, or was it through some other service that they offered?
Yeah, so I have, I'm active in the VA with a primary care provider once a year, go in, and also through the vet center, the counselors at the vet center. They learned about things and informed me about that. I also, I'm pretty strong-willed, and I wasn't going to give up on myself. And I really wanted to look for things that were going to help me make it through just every day, right? My everyday struggle with anxiety and nervousness and PTSD. How can I make every day a little bit easier? And so I was really doing a lot of research on, hey, what can help me? And I talked to my primary care provider at the VA, and she mentioned the acupuncture. She mentioned the massage. And she's like, we'll do massages all the time. If that keeps you, healthy, if that could get you maybe away from, off of some of the medications, you know, that you rely on, hey, we'll do that all day long. So I think it was a combination of me asking questions, of having a really good provider, a good resource at the vet center, just to know about these options out there.
Yeah. So I guess it's really just a matter of, for the people who are listening, ask what's available and see if you can get these types of things. Be your own advocate, I guess, right? You know, go and say, you know, I heard that the VA will cover massages or acupuncture, or maybe there's some other type of therapy or thing that you think might work for whatever it is that you're going through. And it's not necessarily offered by the VA, but maybe they can help with that and cover that. Mm-hmm. So, it's definitely worth asking. You might have to do a little bit of research on your own to figure out what is available out there, even in the community, because if there's no acupuncturist in your area, then that's kind of a moot point, right? You're not going to drive us, 500 miles away to go find an acupuncturist if there's no one there, right? I don't know, maybe you will, but still, it it's one of those things where you might need to do a little research ahead of time before you approach your provider for that type of thing. But I'm glad that you brought those things up, because before we talked, I didn't even realize that those would be things that are available through, not necessarily through the VA, but that they would cover. So that's, I think, great feedback. It's great information for the people who are listening to know that there are other things available. Just because the VA doesn't necessarily offer them, you still could find the help that you need through other organizations that might be out there.
Exactly.
And you also mentioned like the sensory deprivation, like that float tank thing. How did that work for you? I've seen things about it. I've been curious about it. I just never did it. I didn't know really. I couldn't put two and two together. It's like, how would this work? How does this work out? But what was the experience like for you?
Yeah. And I was invited to join. Well, I was invited to go with the counselor through the vet center. Right. So she said, hey, I think we are going to offer this to veterans. Let's go try it out. And I think it's just a big pool of water with salt in it. And you just float there.
But it's like a pod, right? It's like a thing that closes in on you, like almost like an egg.
It's like,
right?
An egg-shaped pod. Yeah. And so you just float there. No music, really no lights. And you just float there. And I think that's very soothing to some people. And that might be an option through the VA. I did not continue on pursuing that. I mean, it sounds super relaxing. I got a little bored, but
I could see that too. Yeah.
But I think when you get over the weirdness of what's going on, I think it could be very relaxing, right. Soothing to some people. So.
Yeah, sure. And I think with all of these things that we were talking about, whether it's the massage or the acupuncture or the medication or the other therapies that people might go through or that you were going through, I think the important thing is you try different things. And if something doesn't work, like acupuncture didn't work out for you, that probably made your anxiety a little bit worse because you don't like needles. And I understand that too, because I don't like needles either. But if that doesn't work for you, it's not like all hope is lost. There's definitely other things out there. And I think it's really a choice to want to get better, to want to be able to cope and deal with some of these stresses and the anxiety and everything better. And if you can certainly choose the other way and just lock yourself in your room and never come out and seclude yourself from the world. And that's your choice. And you certainly could do that, but you know, that's not really living a great life at that point. You're not living to your fullest potential. But then I hear stories like yours and the things that you've done. And you said you're like a fighter. You're going to push through and you're going to keep going. And that's exactly what it sounds like you're doing. You're fighting to get yourself better, to get through whatever issues that are holding you back from living the best version of your own life. And so I applaud you for that. And I think that it's wonderful that you're keep on pushing on and keep on trying new things, because there's something out there. If you haven't tried it yet and you haven't found it yet, there's other things that you haven't tried yet, and you can keep trying and keep trying until you find that thing that works for you. It could be meditation or yoga or any number of other things. There's so many things out there. Could be art therapy or whatever. You know, there's so many things that people do, and they've tried it and been successful with the results, that it's like, there's no way you've tried everything, right? And I'm not talking necessarily specifically to you, Jessica, but I'm talking to whoever might be listening. There's so many things that you could try, and you just have to keep trying and keep fighting for yourself, and not give up on yourself, right? And I think that's the name of the game, really.
Yeah, exactly. Because I wouldn't exactly say that I found that thing that's gonna cure me, right? Or that's gonna help me. But I keep on trying, and sure, it's discouraging. Like, oh man, I can't do acupuncture, but I heard it was really good. Oh man, you know. But I'm not done giving up, right? I know that I'm gonna keep on searching for those things that calm me. So,
yeah, and that's encouraging to hear that side of things, where you've tried something, it didn't work, but you're going to keep trying. And I think that's the message I wanted people to take away from this episode is that just because one thing or two things didn't work for you, all hope isn't lost. It's not like you can just throw in the towel and be like, oh, well, I'm a lost cause. And, you know, this is useless to keep trying. It's not like that at all. You got a lot going for you, and you have a lot to keep pushing for. And so I think that right there just shows that that if you want it bad enough, you can keep fighting for it, and you'll find it. I'm confident that you will. Whatever it happens to be, whatever that thing for you happens to be, you'll find it. It's just a matter of figuring out what works for you. Anything else in life. You know, you go to a restaurant and there's 100 things on the menu, and if you bring 100 people through the restaurant, they may all pick a different thing on the menu, and they may all say that they had a wonderful meal, but they all had different things. So there are hundreds of options out there for things to help you get better. And it's just a matter of trying them all and figuring out what works for you until you find the thing that works, right?
Yeah, I really appreciate this podcast, because it sounds like you're doing great work with bringing all these things together in maybe one spot. So so I'm going to go back and I'm going to look. Maybe some of that arts therapy will be good for me. You know, I thank you for bringing all these resources together in one spot, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really ultimately what I'm trying to do is give the resources and give hope to the people who are feeling like they're at a loss and they don't know where else to turn. And so hopefully things like this and stories like yours that are encouraging for the people who don't know what else to do. It's like, well, just keep trying something, you know, don't just sit there and let things get worse. Try something else. I like that you were able to share that and give that message out. So I really do appreciate it. And I thank you for joining us today to share your story. I know some of the stories, not the most fun thing to talk about, you know, but I think it's, you did a good service to the people who are listening, and I really do appreciate that.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.